Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at treating common injuries and conditions with our two guests, Bill Boisenault. Bill's an associate professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and a senior physical therapist at the Spine Center Physical Therapy Clinic at UW Hospitals and Clinics. And Bill, great to have you back.
Thank you, Larry. Good to be here again.
And Lori Tambrody, Lori's physical therapist and athletic trainer with the UW Sports Medicine and Spine Center. She's also the graduate program director for Rocky Mountain University of Health Professions in Provo, Utah.
Uh-huh. They have snow.
Yeah, they
have. So do we. So we have snow. We do now. I don't think we had snow the last time
Although
we met, did we?
Although I think it's slush. At least we're having here
yeah,
in Madison.
Slush.
Yeah,
it's slush.
This is Yak Tracks weather.
Yeah,
so
it's crummy stuff.
Yeah,
it's
if you haven't pulled them out, these kind of conditions are perfect for that because there's ice and there's snow and there's everything in between.
Yeah. We have black ice, we have ice underneath the slush and snow.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it's pretty treacherous
yeah.
out there.
Would
yeah.
there be conditions that might result as a result of this bad weather that would indicate manual therapy might be in order? Because manual therapy is something I know we wanted to talk about today.
Well,
it's part of a larger program, isn't it?
It is. It's one of the categories of treatment techniques and approaches that we incorporate into most patient care, especially in the outpatient setting, where generally it's a mix of hands-on manual therapy, which can include massage, joint mobilization, manipulation, traction fits in the category. That combined with exercise and inpatient education kind of transcends everything. And so in most cases, manual therapy is most indicated early on in the episode of care to get people over that first hump, getting moving better, start reducing the pain. And from an exercise standpoint, we have some exercises that are designed also to decrease pain. For example, we've had a number of callers over the years where we've mentioned an exercise approach to get pain up out of the leg toward the back or
right.
out of the arm up toward the neck. And then there are other exercises that are more geared toward long-term, you know, the strengthening flexibility to help continue to improve but also help prevent this from coming back again. And then, as I mentioned, patient education fits into all of that. And so, and we've had some callers that have asked, how do I know when I'm seeing a good PT or what should I expect from a physical therapist treatment program? And again, especially in the outpatient setting, it's typically a combination of those three categories.
Right. There's a large body of research that shows that manual therapy, whether it's joint mobilization or some deep tissue massage, can improve pain and function in people with chronic conditions such as arthritis, most notably at the hip. People have arthritis at their hip. There's a fairly large body of literature that shows that manual therapy to increase hip extension, range of motion,
sure.
that is your hip going backwards or your leg going backwards on your pelvis, improves your hip strength and decreases pain. What tends to happen is losing hip extension is something that happens fairly early on in hip arthritis. And so those loads get transmitted on to the lumbar spine. And we often see people who come in with this sort of diffuse buttock pain, and no one can really figure out if it's coming from their back or their hip or some combination of both. And a manual therapy to improve hip range of motion can unload the spine and improve pain in that area, regardless of where the primary source was.
Very cool. Lots of callers online to visit with you, too, so I'm thinking we should just go right to the phones here. And Anson in Waukesha, it is your turn. Hello, thank you very much for calling.
Yeah, hi, I'm a long-distance runner, and I have what my friends like to call a trick calf, and which means that it just sometimes just goes out on me, like I never know what's going to happen. I've read up that it's due to excessive stretching. So I haven't been stretching it as much, but the thing is anymore, like it's been in pain for like the past month. I thought it got better, so I ended up doing a 5K yesterday, and it just kind of went out in mid-race, and I had to end up limping through the across the finish line. What can I do to prevent this pain from coming? Is there anything I can maybe wear around my calf or leg or something? Because this happens frequently. This has been happening frequently, like maybe once in a year within the last 5 years.
So this is calf pain, and you're a distance runner?
Yes.
And is there any pattern to this pain? For example, the time of year it comes on, what kind of training you've been doing, weather conditions, training conditions?
No, I just do running and stretching. It's happened in the summer. It's happened in the winter. I do outdoor running, like, all year round. It's a kind of a bummer because now I'm going to have to pay a month to go to the gym, and I like to be outdoors all year round.
So where in your calf do you get this pain?
It's just the entire, it feels like the entire calf, but, like, just as it's finished healing, it kind of feels like there's a knot right in the middle of the calf.
In back?
Yeah.
In the back of your calf?
Yes.
Okay, and it's not on the outside. You get any symptoms down in your foot or toes?
No,
numbness,
no,
tingling,
nothing.
Anything like that?
Nope, nothing. It's only in the calf. The only thing I can really do to get it better is wait to put ice on it, elevate it, and wait for it to get better. But sometimes when a pain goes away, I'm not really sure if it's completely healed. Because like I said, the race I just did yesterday, it just came back.
And
all of a sudden, mid-race.
And it's only in one leg, not the other.
Well, I've had it in both legs, but I haven't had it in my right leg for maybe 3 years.
Okay. You know, this is an unusual enough problem that I'd go in and have this looked at. There could be some deep muscle issue. It could be a deep compartment issue, you know, which could be more related to your training. But it's not a typical presentation of the majority of musculoskeletal problems that we see in the calf. So when you have one of these episodes, and now you appear to be in one of them now, this would be the time to be seen when you're symptomatic, so somebody can sort it out. They can find the area that's tender, if there is a tender area. They can do some muscle tests to see if a specific muscle can elicit your symptoms. They can put you on a treadmill and watch you run and see if there's something about your gait that precipitates this, but I think it needs to be seen. There's also medical issues, vascular issues that can be part of this as well. So it'd be good to have that sorted out.
Okay.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And Mary in Waukesha, let's turn to you now. Hi, Mary.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
About a week ago, I had an ablation procedure on my L3, 4, and 5. And I'm wondering, they say it takes a while to heal, but I'm wondering if physical therapy would play any part in helping with this process of healing or getting better function back.
Yeah, it's a nerve ablation.
Yes.
And so I'm assuming you were having quite a bit of leg pain before this, is that correct?
Mostly lower back and upper thigh.
Okay, and upper thigh. So the idea is if you deaden some of the nerves, it allows the tissues to heal, it removes the pain source, and then the idea over time, the nerves will grow back. Mary, and this is similar to injections elsewhere in the body. The hope is that after a week or two goes by after the procedure, that you start rehabilitation. The hope is that if it's decreased pain enough, that it opens up some doors for us from a rehab perspective. We can tend to be a little more aggressive. We can do some exercises that we couldn't do before that are related to strengthening the trunk and the pelvic area and help improve your flexibility. Because the idea is before this type of procedure is that you're unable to tolerate enough activity or exercise to really recover.
That's correct.
But once the pain source has been taken care of at least to a degree, again, that's the idea, that you do this in conjunction with rehabilitation. When do you go back and talk to the physician again?
Well, actually, they said that they'd probably call me in 3 weeks to see how I was doing.
Okay.
I'm just thinking, you know, would there be some type of PT that might help this process along of healing?
Yeah, the answer is yes. There should be a role for a physical therapist. What you could do is, you know, you could call a physician's office up and just get a timeline from them. If they were thinking that in that 3 week call, that's when they would start other aspects of the program, you can ask, is there any reason why you can't start now as opposed to waiting? It'd be worth a phone call.
Were you in physical therapy prior to your surgery?
I did try it before, and it was just too painful.
Yeah. Okay. You could go back to that physical therapist also, now that you've had this procedure, and call them and say, okay, I've had this procedure, I'm feeling better now, is this the time to come back and try this again?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then, they can contact your physician, and if there's any precautions at all. But usually, again, this is designed to open some doors for you.
Yeah. There you go. Good luck.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Mary, for calling. William in Madison, on to you now. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I give a recommendation to some people. When I was a young fella, I was in athletics. I was captain of a couple of sports at a big school and everything like this, you know. But I recommend that when you get to be in your 50s and 60s, don't pick your sweet 16. You know, don't go long-distance running or all this sort of thing. Because what happened to me is last February, one morning, I woke up out of bed, sharp pain in my right hip. I went to physical therapy, reduced it somewhat, all summer long, fall, tried to get along. Then I went to a doctor, said, Will, your hip is all gone. You're just a bone on bone. We're going to have to put artificial hip into you.
Wow. So an artificial hip.
Well, you know, one of the things, William, is you never know who is going to develop degenerative joint disease and at what rate. So, you know, to sit around and not exercise because you might develop arthritis can actually accelerate arthritis. There's a fine balance of the right amount of exercise to keep your muscles, joints, your heart healthy. And it's a matter of picking the right exercise to match your joints. So there are people who shouldn't run because their joints really can't handle it. There are many people who run into their 80s and 90s and do so successfully because they inherited really good joint surfaces from their parents. Mm. So I hesitate to make a global statement of everyone should or shouldn't do anything. I think the only way I would say is that everyone should find the exercise that matches their desires, their pleasures, what they enjoy, and what works for their body type and their physical condition.
Yeah. Yep. And his point of, you know, remember, we're not sweet 16 anymore. I'm reminded of that every morning when I wake up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, but, you know, but it is a point that we've made, you know, over the years. People get in trouble with lack of transitioning. So they start an activity too high intensity, too frequent, and then the body breaks down as opposed to transitioning into an activity, especially if you're starting something new or you've had to take off 3-4 months, whatever reason you're starting up again. To think that you're going to be able to start at your usual level can get some people into trouble. So transitioning carefully and working with people who can coach you along the way can also make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show as we talk treating common injuries and conditions with Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne Brody. I'm Larry Mueller. Rachel Owens, our on-air producer today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lots of callers online with questions for Bill and Lori, so I think we should go right back to the phones. And Vivian in Reedsburg, we are on to you. Hi, Vivian.
Hi, good morning. The age-old question of plantar fasciitis and how do you get rid of it? I have seen my primary care doctor, and he said, yes, this is what I have. He's told me to take ibuprofen, 600 milligrams, 3 times a day. I've been doing that. I had actually been doing a little lesser dosage before I went to see him. It's been going on about, I'm saying 2 months now at this point. I've done the stretching, haven't done the icing religiously. He said ultimately that I may need to go to an ortho for a steroid injection.
Oh, there are many steps in between there.
Okay.
Where did you get instructed in your stretching?
Online.
Okay.
I mean, I do the stretching off the stair. I do stretching with a towel.
Okay.
Lying with my leg up in the air.
Okay. Are you pulling your toes back or just stretching your calf?
My toes back.
Okay. Very good. Yeah. So pulling your toes back is one of the key stretches. Oftentimes, people are instructed in simple calf stretching, which isn't sufficient. If you haven't seen a physical therapist, this would be the time to do it. Do you know why this started?
Actually, we were skiing out in Colorado right around November 1st, and it was deep, heavy snow without much conditioning ahead of it.
Okay.
and it seems to have intense. I've never had it before, and it has occurred after this. Coincidence? I don't know.
Okay. All right. So, are there any? Is there anything you're doing in your life right now that's perpetuating this that you think of? Are you on your feet a lot? Are you
a
walker?
I'm a nurse.
You're a nurse.
Yeah,
okay.
So I'm on my feet a lot. I have run in the past, but I cannot run. I can't even walk my dog 2 miles now without getting pain.
Okay. All right. So there are some significant barriers to getting better, most notably being on your feet as a nurse. So, so getting some professional help with this is a good idea. There are night splints that work quite well. There's some arch strengthening exercises. Getting at the cause helps figure out whether there's a big component of your anatomy or how you move or how you walk that was part of this predisposing problem. But if it was an unusual situation like the skiing, then once you get rid of this, it may not come back. But I'd go in and I'd see PT and I would get the night splints. I'd try those things. I'd do icing more religiously. I would hold off on the steroid shots absolutely as long as I could.
That's kind of what I was thinking too. I'm 55 years old, so I'm older too. I probably should lose 15 pounds, that kind of thing.
We all should.
Okay, so basically, you have to see a PT.
Yeah, see a PT, and the night splints, it take 2 to 3 months, people say. That's how long it took for me. For me, it took me a year to get over because I wouldn't stop running. But eventually, this will go away if you stick with it.
That's my next question. I know you shouldn't necessarily run through pain, but as far as just walking through pain and doing the activities I like to do, I don't want to put my life on hold for a year.
You know, I'd get in with PT. I would try the night splints and I would see what kind of progress you're making. In the meantime, I'd get in a pool if you could and exercise there where you don't have all your weight on it, or on a bike. You could try those alternatives and then add in some walking, but maybe not at the same distance or intensity that you were.
Okay, so walking will, obviously the pain is worse, will it worsen the problem is my question.
Yes.
Okay.
Vivian, when you go into PT, bring your shoes that you commonly wear at work and home. Sometimes the footwear can also make a difference.
And
there's some good patterns of wear, sometimes the bottoms of the shoes, that give us some clues and information too.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And let's go to our Facebook page here. Charlene wonders, what kind of exercises are appropriate during recovery of a fractured ankle in a boot cast?
Okay, so she is still in a boot cast. Is that correct?
Yes.
I don't see it over here. I see it now. It depends upon what your physician lets you do. It depends upon where your fracture is, how many fragments there are, how serious a fracture was, whether or not you can come out of your boot. So if you're able to come out of your boot, we typically have you do range of motion exercises and isometrics. While you're in your boot, typically you can do isometrics, that is putting the outside border of your foot against a stationary object and pushing just to tighten those muscles, to keep those muscles conditioned. And it doesn't mean you have to push with all of your might, but pushing gently just as a reminder to those muscles how to work to enhance the blood flow to that area, it's all going to be good for it. But if you have questions and you're not sure what you should or shouldn't do, I would get in touch with a physician and maybe an appointment with a physical therapist who can go over with you safe ways to maintain your strength and range of motion while you're in the boot. Will speed your recovery when you come out of the boot.
Yeah, those are always really good questions when people leave the orthopedist's office, is what they can expect between now and the next visit, and what they importantly cannot do, and what is okay for them to do, and the best way to do that.
There we go. Norman in Wausau, it is your turn. Hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'd like to ask your guests what they would suggest. I've been diagnosed with either piriformis syndrome or ischial gluteal bursitis. I've had it for about 2.5 years. I've seen an orthopedist, a physiatrist, and a physical therapist numerous times. And I've done the exercises. I've taken the Celebrex and some of the other pain relievers. I've had injections. The steroids have worked for short periods of time, like 1.5 to 3.5, 4 weeks. But I hate to keep getting those. And the exercises, I'm not sure that they've helped me or not. The main problem I have is sleeping on my left side or my back at night because I have to use a CPAP machine, so I have to either sleep on my side or my back, so now I'm limited to my right side. That's when it bothers the worst. It also bothers when I sit down, but not as much now as it did, you know, let's say a year ago, and whether that's from doing the exercise or what, I don't know that it has helped a little bit on that. But my question to you is this. Is there anything else that you would think of that I can or should be doing to help this situation out? I don't have the sciatic-like pain running down my leg. I've had that before. It doesn't run down my leg. It seems to stay in the upper half of my upper leg and my lower torso, in other words, over the buttock mainly.
Well, it sounds like you're improving, but clearly not enough yet. Getting the pain out of the leg usually is the first step. The piriformis is a deep muscle in the buttock. We have one on each side, and it has a very close anatomic relationship with the sciatic nerve. And there is times that that muscle can cause irritation. The ischiotuberosity bursa, we have two sit bones on each side, and that's called the ischiotuberosity, and there's a bursa there, a sac, a fluid-filled sac that helps it accommodate through friction. And sometimes it can be difficult to sort out between the two what's causing that local problem. Norman, for exercises, are you stretching your hamstrings or doing a straight leg raise stretch at all?
Right. I bring that affected leg, I do it the other one too, up, and then I bring my lower leg across my other leg and up, and okay. That puts stretch on that. Also, he had me lay on a tennis, a golf ball, right where that hurt, right over the tuberosity.
Yeah.
Then roll on one of these soft foam roller things, about 6-inch diameter, you know, a cylinder.
Right. Yeah, it's got to do a self-massage. You know, sometimes that area can get overstretched, and sometimes it's better to leave that area alone for a while. The other question I have is how much of this might be related to your lumbar spine, your low back?
They did an MRI, and they did not find any evidence.
Okay.
I was having I did have a problem there about 10 years ago. In fact, I had back surgery for that, where I had a calcification right in the foramina.
Okay.
Cutting down on the exit of one of the sciatic nerve branches,
yeah.
And that was paralyzing me, actually. But that was taken care of, and then I didn't have this buttock problem at that time. This was a recent development.
Okay. All right. Well, trunk stabilization is really important for you in positions that are comfortable for you. And so a trunk stability program, I don't know if you have access to a pool. I think maybe the buoyancy of the water may allow you to be a little more aerobic, and you can do some good core strengthening in the water as well. And the stretching, I guess I recommend that you continue stretching, but I wouldn't stretch very aggressively or very hard. Think more of coaxing as opposed to stretching. Okay. Again, sometimes the stretching can be overdone, but really working on the core stability, I think would be important for you. Again, the fact that sciatica is pretty much gone is a really good thing, and that bodes well that more improvement can occur.
I never had the sciatica with this. It was just that pain that was so bad. If I laid down more than a couple of minutes in the bed, horizontally in the bed, I couldn't stand it. I'd have to roll over to my other side.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes it was really severe sitting. That is, I'd have to, and I do use one of these donuts in my chairs.
Okay.
I would have to sometimes get up and shift over to my right side completely and kind of straighten
okay.
my leg.
Yeah, to get pressure off of that.
Yeah.
Well, I guess, I would back off on the golf ball. I would do really gentle stretching, but I wouldn't just stretch the buttock. I would stretch the inside of your thigh. I would stretch your quadriceps, other aspects of the hip, to see if you can increase mobility of the hip in general. That would take some tension off that piriformis area. And again, the core stability also would be important for you, Norman.
Thanks.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And more callers online. Let's take a call from Bill next in Sun Prairie. Bill, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm one of these guys that have tried to take care of themselves all their lives. I started jogging in June of 1972. And about 4 years ago, I couldn't jog anymore because my left knee got kind of messed up, and went in for an arthroscopic surgery where they cleaned up the meniscus. And I asked the doctor, can I keep running? And he says, well, I can't tell you you can't. So I did. Yeah. My lady friend said, you know, you're crazy. I says, well, maybe I got jogger's dementia from all the pounding. I'm starting to lose it. But anyway, now I'm starting to get the pain back, and, you know, I can't run anymore, so I've been doing some fast walking. I've got two questions. Number one, what would you suggest? How do you suggest I might approach the knee problem again? Just another scope, and I'm also starting to get a little pain in my right hip. And number two, what could I do to keep up aerobic exercises? I don't want to stop. I'm going to be 70 years old this year. Oh. So I'd welcome your comments.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing is you had the scope. I don't know if you are a candidate for Synvisc injections. Have you had any injections in your knee?
No.
Okay.
What is that?
That's the equivalent of WD-40. You know, where it's a lubricant, basically. It's made of the hyaluronate molecule, which is one of the backbones of your collagen molecule. So they typically do a series of about 3 injections in your knee, and many people get quite a bit of relief, you know, for a year's worth of relief potentially from a series of these injections. So, you know, nobody's exactly sure what's happening, but the effects of it exceed the half-life of the material, of the Synvisc itself. So it's not just the physical presence of the Synvisc that's making a difference, but there is some change in your knee joint itself.
Would you spell that?
S-Y-N-V-I-S-C.
Okay.
So you could go back to the surgeon who operated on your knee, because that person knows your knee best, and find out if you're a candidate for that. For some people, their arthritis is too advanced and the Synvisc won't help. So I guess my first stop would be back there and say, okay, what you got now? And I would certainly include a visit to the physical therapist to find out what you can do to maintain your cardio status. First, in terms of the health of your knee, keeping your quadriceps, your glutes, your core very strong are really important. There's a large body of literature suggesting that the importance of core muscles in protecting your peripheral joints, such as your hip and knee, that having good strength there will offload those joints. So getting set up on a strengthening program for those muscles would be key. And then alternative would be, you know, I'd start at this point with some non-weight-bearing or limited-weight-bearing activity, such as biking, where you have a high spin with not much resistance, so that can help lubricate the joint. Exercising in a pool, it doesn't have to be swimming, but there's a tremendous amount of exercise you can do that's aerobic, that's in a pool, that will not overload your knee.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So those are some things to consider.
And Bill, when you go in, the physical therapist would also look at your feet and your ankles, the structure, the posture of your feet and ankles, and your footwear, because that may be impacting what's happening at your knee as well. So bring in your running shoes and a pair of shorts, and they should take a good look at you.
And good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Pat. Bill, appreciate it. Pat's coming up next, as a matter of fact, from Fond du Lac. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly here. Now let's go to Pat in Fond du Lac. Hi, Pat.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Good. I have a follow-up to the woman with plantar fasciitis and then a question about an issue that I'm having.
Okay.
I'm a cyclist, and being a cyclist in Wisconsin in the winter doesn't work real well. So I decided last winter I was going to start running on the treadmill, and almost right away I developed plantar fasciitis. I have a friend who is a long-distance endurance runner, and he runs barefoot, and he suggested I get some barefoot running shoes, and I did, and what a difference those made for my plantar fasciitis. I'm still dealing with it, but it's 90% better than it was before. So I just wanted to throw that out there if that was something she wanted to do. But then also for the last year, I've been dealing with tennis elbow. and it is just not getting any better despite everything the orthopedic guy is telling me to do. Are there any exercises that I can do on my own that will strengthen that area?
Well, what has the orthopedic guy been telling you to do? What have you done?
Keep taking ibuprofen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's not going to get you over, particularly if you continue to use that arm, wrist, and hand for any kind of activity.
Yeah, I'm actually a bicycle mechanic, so I'm constantly using hand tools with it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I actually skewered myself a couple times trying to figure out how to use a screwdriver left-handed.
Oh, dear.
Oh, boy.
Oh, dear. Well, you could think about some ergonomic tools, considering that you use tools for living. But what tends to be most successful is a fairly heavy eccentric resistive program for your wrist extensor muscles. So what that means is if you're sitting in a chair with an arm, you have your palm facing down and your wrist just over the edge of the chair. And with your opposite arm, you lift up your wrist so that your wrist is cocked up, and then you hold the weight and you lower it down.
Okay.
And you do that fairly heavy and it will hurt. But if you stick with it, eventually you should get better.
Okay.
You should be able to do 8 to 10 repetitions of it. So you would choose a weight that you could do approximately 8 to 10 repetitions of. What you might do is you might see what your maximum is on the opposite side and then go to about 60% of that weight to start on your injured side.
Okay.
And start with that and see how you do. So that's kind of a ballpark about where you might start with
sure.
the weight. And doing a couple sets a day to, you know, fatigue where you can't lower it anymore. And if you get up and you can do 12 to 15 reps, then your weight needs to go up.
Okay.
So that's a typical program. And if you Google, you might be able to find it somewhere on the internet, this eccentric program. And that's the lowering phase of the muscle contraction.
There you go.
So, and I guess back to the barefoot running thing, we didn't really comment on that. There's a fairly large movement toward barefoot running, although the number of people that run barefoot is still small. I mean, you have to be careful of hazards in the environment, such as nails, glass, rocks, things like that. So many people have switched to the the Vibram five-fingered shoe. We know you have your toes, so it's just a light covering for your foot to protect it. They still haven't sorted out what it is about the barefoot running that's useful for some people. It's obviously not going to be good for everybody, but people who run barefoot run with a different mechanical style than people who run in a shoe. And so, you know, people were saying, well, it's related to the muscle strength in your foot, because when you walk or run barefoot, you really strengthen those muscles. And people who run in shoes, their intrinsic foot muscles are weaker because they have the protection of the shoe. And when they've done strength testing and things like that, they've found that that isn't really borne out. So there's still a lot of ongoing research trying to figure out what it is that works for some people. And we don't know the answer to that. But again, as Bill said earlier, one of the things would be if you're going to make a change like that, it's really dramatic. You've taken away your cushioning. You've changed how you run. You really have to move into it slowly.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Harold and Superior, we are on to you. Hi, Harold.
Well, I got on so quick, I couldn't believe it. I was expecting a busy signal.
Well, I'm glad to have you on. What's on your mind?
Well, I have three quickies, and I promise to make it quick, but I need to get all three in. And I don't need an immediate answer. I'll take it offline. McKinsey Institute, I have a book called Treat Your Own Back, and I'm wondering what you folks think of it, if you have any particular issues with any parts of it, back extensions and so on. I'm assuming you're familiar with it.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Number two, neuropathy, and this is kind of a public service announcement. About 20 years ago, at least, maybe 25, I was complaining about tingling in my feet so on and so forth. And then it kind of come and go, and then it got a little worse, and then come and go. And, well, now I have neuropathy and diabetes to go with it. And people got to know that, boy, if you've got something, and I keep pestering the doctors, and they say, well, no, you got perfect circulation. I said, my feet get so cold, so easy, I can't believe it. And so it only leaves one other thing, you know, I mean, other than, what's that one, rhinos, but they need to know that, gee, maybe you've got some beginning of a nerve problem, could be related to diabetes. Thirdly, wondering if there is any particular treatments, therapies for neuropathy and any particular do's and don'ts along that line.
Okay, thanks very much for calling. Bill?
Yeah, good questions. First, with the McKenzie Treat Your Own Back book, it has been around for probably a couple of decades, and it is designed to educate the public in terms of self-care, self-management. And there are probably, I think, 10 to 12 chapters in the book. One chapter relates to posture, sitting posture, standing posture, sleeping postures, to put your back in a good neutral position where there's minimal load on it. And just a lot of common sense information in terms of positioning. There's also a good chapter related to pain. What's an okay kind of pain and what's a not okay kind of pain. And we've mentioned, as part of the McKenzie approach, is the further away from the back the pain moves down into the leg, generally the more irritated the back is. So they talk about the peripheralization versus centralization, and the goal is to get the pain out of the leg up into the back, and they relate that to posture and movements. And I think that's very helpful. People understand what's going on with their back. From an exercise perspective, they do promote a lot of trunk extension or backward bending in early stages, which for some back conditions, that's exactly what people need. But the goal of that is to get the pain up toward the middle of the back, and then you work on getting it out of the back completely. So there's a lot of good self-help day-to-day information for the public. In terms of the issue with the neuropathy and the idea of the pins and needles in the feet, anytime people have pins and needles, numbness, especially if it's in both hands, both feet, or a combination of feet and hands, and they haven't seen a physician, they need to go see a physician. It can be lots of things. It could be related to their neck or their back. It could be something like diabetes. Could be related to a medication, but they need to be seen. What Harold described, though, is not necessarily all that rare, where in the early stage, it's difficult to identify what is the cause of these complaints. But if they see a physician, and it's still kind of an unknown as to why, if it continues to get worse, they need to go back, because sometimes something will show up on a blood test at point B where it didn't 3 months earlier. So to push it and to stay on top of those kinds of symptoms is really important. From a treatment perspective, a key is treating the underlying cause first and foremost. Anything that can be done to help control the diabetes and other vascular conditions is critical, because without that, it won't really impact. No matter what you do to your feet, it's not going to help if the diabetes, in this case, isn't addressed. The thing to be careful of with these kinds of neuropathies is really watching skin very closely. Skin can break down, and you start getting open wounds and ulcers that can lead to infection. So, you know, skin care, foot care is really, really important. It's critical. And there are some activities related to balance that are important, because as you have this kind of sensory changes, then falls are a big issue. And so there are balance activities that are important too.
Let's turn to Dan in Eau Claire next, and we'll do that in just a minute. Just to remind you, Bill Boysen on Lurie Tyne Brody, our guest today, as we talk treating common injuries and conditions. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. And now let's turn our attention to Dan in Eau Claire. Hi, Dan. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've had a low back problem for the last 10 or 12 years that acts up probably five times in the past 12 years. The last time was about 2.5 years ago. And it can happen just from normal movement, not necessarily doing anything that's too straining. Started out with maybe just tying a shoe with your foot up on a chair, where all of a sudden this piercing, debilitating, sending you to your knees pain strikes you, and it lingers then for about 3 weeks afterwards. I can't get dressed, I can't put socks on, I can't use the bathroom in a normal way, I can't even reach my hands underneath the sink or put my chin down to my my chest without it, I call it twinging. And it's takes quite a while to get back to normal. I've seen chiropractors and a physical therapist for it. I am doing some hamstring stretches, and I know I need to work on my core, but I think it has to do a lot with my pelvis also, because at physical therapy, they seem to be able to do something where the therapist would use pushing force while I pushed out with my knees, and just the opposite. She would push out while I would try to push in with my knees, and something was aligning my pelvis. But any suggestions of other exercises I can do? Or I'm very mechanical right now with getting dressed. I still put my socks on in bed, crossing one leg over the other, or sleeping positions, or, I mean, even vacuuming. I have to watch lunging, I guess, and I just wanted to see what your guests had thought about that.
Okay.
Well, I understand why you're doing this thing slowly and guardedly, because if this comes out of the blue like that, you're kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop. You know, what you described then is not that uncommon in terms of stories that I've heard over the years, where you wouldn't think bending over to tie your shoes should cause any kind of an injury or a flare-up. And I have people, it's a sneeze, they reach for something, they lean for something, and kind of what you have to consider is that one activity, it was probably the last straw on the proverbial camel's back. In most cases, it's been building up. It's subclinical, because you're not really having symptoms, but whether muscles are slowly getting weaker over time, or there's a little more strain on the ligaments and joints in that low lumbar spine, and then that one minor thing puts you over the edge. What's critical is hip flexibility is really, really important, so that when you do bend and twist and move, the more that happens at your hips, then the less load falls on your spine. And it's not just hamstring stretching. It's stretching the quads, the front of the hip, the muscles inside your hip, as well as some hamstring stretching. But hip flexibility in general in all directions is really important. And then the core stabilization and the strengthening through the hips and the trunk also is critical. Again, the better those muscles can support you, then these kinds of activities shouldn't flare you up. Part of the strengthening also should be dynamic in nature. Generally, you start more isometric where you're not moving, but you need to progress over time where you're strengthening with movement. So you're using a foam roller or an exercise ball. So that works on your balance and your reflex, the timing of muscles kicking in, and not just the strength. So your strengthening program should be progressed or have progressed to where there's a dynamic component to it. And the issue with the pelvis and resetting the pelvis with muscle contraction, that is a common technique when your lumbar spine sits right on top of the pelvis, so if there is some asymmetry. But generally, that tends to be more of a short-term fix. Okay. There's a reason why these episodes are continuing to come back. So that's generally how I would approach somebody with this kind of history.
You know, one of the questions is, that whatever the manual therapy that was done with your pelvis, and that is the kind of manual therapy where you're pushing and pulling and the therapist is pushing and pulling in an opposite direction, you can learn to do some of those independently. And I don't know if the therapist taught you how to do a self-mobilization in that area. If you can feel at some point when your pelvis is no longer aligned and you can self-mobilize it, that might be helpful for you to keep your pelvis and your spine in better alignment.
Yeah, I tried something with a ball where she could say I could push in on a smaller, like a 6 to 8 inch ball. Although I really can't feel the misalignment, although I have to admit the last 2 weeks my hip has felt, my pain's been a little bit like that, but a little bit differently, not that sharp take away your breath, where you can't even, but even getting in my car, everything I do is very mechanical, to the point where I'm probably over mechanical at the moment.
Right. Well, this might be the time to go in and be seen rather than waiting, for the wheels to come off.
Okay.
And if you went in and you took whatever ball you have and have the therapist show you how to do it using your ball instead of her doing it with you and then saying you can do it this way at home, have her actually do that with you, with your equipment, so that you know how to do it.
Should I be afraid to go in for a massage or try something like a deep tissue? I'm just afraid to even have anyone manipulate that area, thinking it's not too bad right now, but anytime, you know.
Well, I think if you go to someone who's licensed, and generally if they don't put hard direct pressure right over the spine, and you give them feedback, you know, when you're getting a massage like that or deep pressure, it hurts, but it should kind of hurt good, like I need that spot, as opposed to anything that approaches the sharpness that you feel. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think in conjunction with the other things that Lori and I just described, I think generally that can be a good thing for, but as long as you go to someone who's licensed and has worked with people with back pain in the past.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling, Dan. And Bill in McFarland, on to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I know you've been working with, talking about hips and legs and stuff like that, but I've got a problem with my shoulder, and I've been... I think it's an injury, but I'm not really sure. I went to my physician, and he tends to think it might be early arthritis, stuff like that. But I have a problem when I sleep that if I end up with my arm over my head, I'll wake up, and I can't move my right arm back down into position, back over my head. I have to pick it up with my left hand and physically bring it back down to my side, and the pain is just excruciating. My oldest sibling, I'm in my mid-50s, my oldest sibling, they all, three of them, have trouble with their neck. They can't turn from, they can't look from side to side. I'm wondering if they're, now I have some pain in my neck, in my lower neck, right where my shoulders connect, and I'm wondering if there could be something wrong with my neck, you know, like needs to be manipulated by a chiropractor, and if there is something, could that contribute to the pain in my shoulder? Could that be like transmitting down into my shoulder?
Okay, well, let's start with the shoulder. So when you say that you have to use your other arm to lower it down, is it because your arm is asleep, or is it because it hurts so bad that you can't move it?
It hurts so bad I can't move it.
Okay, and where is the pain? Is it right on top of your shoulder, or does it go down your arm into your elbow or hand?
It doesn't go down into my elbow or hand. Well, it does a little bit. There's a nerve that I can feel, a nerve that goes down from my armpit down into my elbow, kind of that funny bone thing.
Uh-huh.
And that hurts a lot, but the pain is like in my armpit and in the front of my shoulder.
Okay, and then when you use your other arm to bring your arm back down, then what happens?
The pain subsides.
Okay.
It still hurts a lot, and I'll massage it, and then the pain will not go away, but it subsides a little.
So then during the day, do you notice it, or is it fine during the day?
It's kind of always there.
Okay.
Lately, it's been kind of always there. I like when I lift my arm to do something, or
okay,
reach for something, or lift my arm up at all.
Okay. Well, if this is your dominant arm, you know, it sounds more like a primary shoulder problem than a neck problem. It certainly could have a neck component to it. And as with any problem, when you have more than one thing going on in an area, it gets harder and harder to diagnose. So it's perfectly reasonable that you could have a component of a shoulder problem and a component of a neck problem. Typically, neck problems will refer pain down past your elbow into your forearm, wrist, and hand. Usually, and this is a generalization, but usually pain that only goes to your elbow is coming from your shoulder. And given that the position that aggravates it is with your arm fully overhead, it's a really tough position for your shoulder. When your arm's fully overhead, you put a tremendous amount of pressure on your rotator cuff tendon, your biceps tendon, and your subacromial bursa. And it could, with a little bit of arthritis in your shoulder, it could make it really angry. And, you know, that could precipitate your problems. And the fact that you bring your arm down in your shoulder, although the pain doesn't go away, feels better, tells me that it may be more positional related to your shoulder. Okay. And in any case, going in and having it looked at by a physical therapist, they could do a number of tests to sort out whether there's a neck component or not and get you started on some exercises to rehabilitate your shoulder.
I have been doing some exercises now, and the flare-ups don't seem to be as bad or as frequent as they were. Like,
okay.
I stopped exercising there for a while, and
okay.
it seemed like that was happening every 4 to 6 months I'd have that problem. But since I've been exercising, it seems to be less.
Okay. And where were you instructed in those exercises?
I'm sorry?
And where were you instructed in those exercises?
I just started doing it. I just started walking and doing some lifting and stretching.
Okay.
And
well, in terms of your rotator cuff, there are exercises that are better for your rotator cuff and things that are not so good for your rotator cuff. So again, a visit with a physical therapist, they could fine-tune those exercises for you that to maybe get you over that last hump.
Okay. Would I want to, before I go see a chiropractor about my neck, would I want maybe my physician to maybe x-ray it and make sure that it could take manipulation?
Wouldn't you want to see a physical therapist? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to have somebody manipulate your neck, plain films, x-rays, they don't always help. It really should be driven by the types of symptoms that you're having. The clinical exam would help a practitioner decide whether manipulation is appropriate for you or not. And so, I mean, there's no harm in calling your physician and running that question past them. But in most cases, the x-rays or plain films don't help that much in terms of making that decision.
There you go. Thank you for calling. Bill Boisenault, Lori Tyne Brody will be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You know, it's great to exercise and be active, but without attention to safety, sometimes a wrong turn or maybe a bad twist can lead to aches and pains or even worse. And of course, there are also chronic conditions that we need to manage by someone who knows what they're doing. Larry Mueller here. Now, that's not me, by the way. There are some people, though, right here in the studio with me who are very good at it. Lori Tyne Brody and Bill Boisenault, our physical therapists, will be with us right up until 12:30 today to answer your questions about pains and sprains and strains when you call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page. I had a couple of posts on the Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show. And if you like the page, while you're there, you'll get daily updates on upcoming show topics. We'll be right back after this quick look at the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at dealing with common injuries and conditions. Bill Boisenault, Associate Professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Lori Tyne Brody, Physical Therapist and Athletic Trainer with the UW Sports Medicine and Spine Center, our guests. And Mary in Chippewa Falls has been waiting a while. So let's go right to Mary and see what's on her mind. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have two issues. I have arthritis, and the issues that my knees and my hips don't have arthritis. I mean, I haven't. Don't have the arthritis there, and I'm trying to prevent it from going in those two places. And I can't do a complete. I used to do ballet and things, but I can't do a complete plié or a complete lunge. I'd like to be able to rise from being seated on the floor to my feet with my legs instead of having to use my arms or pull myself up. But I'm afraid to push myself with the lunges and things because I'm afraid to go too far, and I don't know how far I can go without actually hurting the joint. What I'd like to do is strengthen it so I can maybe protect the joint, but I don't want to hurt it in the process. And the other thing with my hips is it's sort of like catches. It's been doing it for, 20 years, but I used to be able to just kind of shake my leg out and it would uncatch, but then I got to a point where it would stay that way and it would really hurt and I couldn't. One time, the last time it was really bad, about maybe 7 years ago, I crawled to a chiropractor, and which I almost never do go to a chiropractor, and he very violently, after taking an x-ray, he told me that my tailbone was caught on my hip bone. And he you know, there was this machine I laid down on, and he kind of violently just pounced on me, and the machine broke away from under my hip, and it was back, and it was like I walked away from there. It wasn't perfectly perfect, but I don't know. I don't know if they're related or not, but it seems to me that I should be able to do a plié or a lunge, and I don't know how to. There must be some kind of
Something you can do. Okay.
Yes, but you're right to be concerned, because if you do repetitive things like lunges, it can flare up your kneecap joint. So while you're strengthening your hip and your leg muscles to protect the big joints, it aggravates other joints. So I think seeing a physical therapist and getting instructed in strengthening exercises for your glutes, your butt muscles, and your quads in a way that will help you get up out of a chair that isn't going to aggravate your hips and knee joints would be a wise thing to do. You were really stated very clearly the problem of getting out of a chair, but yet, you know, doing the lunges and the pliés, which are the movement of getting out of the chair, which would be the most logical thing to do, really can overload your joints. So go in and see somebody, and they can give you some exercises to do that will protect your joints. In terms of the issue of your hip bone getting caught, I'm not sure what it was about your hip bone getting caught on your tailbone, but if you have, for example, catching in your sacroiliac joint, you know, that can cause some similar symptoms that respond to manual therapy, like a manipulation or a mobilization. You can also have a primary hip problem, like a labral problem, and it's a thick cartilage in your hip joint, and we get labral tears in there, just like we do in the shoulder or the knee, and that can cause catching in the joint, that if you kind of shake it out, it can reposition itself. So, again, the physical therapist could evaluate your pelvis and hips and get an idea of what's going on there.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you, Mary, for calling. Appreciate it. And Glenn in Franklin, on to you now. Hi, Glenn.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am a 60-year-old weightlifter who is experiencing some rotator cuff soreness. It's not real bad pain. And I would like to know what type of warm-up exercises you would recommend at the gym for me.
Well, if you haven't had any primary rotator cuff problems, I would do a general warm-up program using large muscle groups that warms up your whole body, as well as some dynamic movements with your shoulder with lighter weights. So, some shoulder rotations with a light weight in a position that protects your shoulder that is below shoulder height. So I would combine some arm movements with some leg movements and some dynamic patterns at a lower intensity level. And then in terms of protecting the rotator cuff during your weight training program, I would certainly incorporate some specific rotator cuff strengthening exercises, such as lifts in the scapular plane, shoulder external rotations, things like that. And I'd be very careful with my bench press, because your rotator cuff acts as a stabilizer while doing the bench. And although the pectorals and lat muscles have the strength and ability to push up a lot of weight, your rotator cuff doesn't usually have sufficient strength to stabilize the joint during that motion, and that's when people get into trouble.
I have been limiting the what I do in any movement overhead.
Okay, that's a good idea.
Yeah, that's a good idea, Glenn, in terms of how much weight and also your trunk position, and I'm sure this is probably what you've already done, but for example, the military press, you don't want to be lifting straight up overhead. I mean, you can use an inclined bench so your trunk is leaning back a little bit and then push up toward the ceiling. And even with the lat pull-downs, if you pull it behind your neck, then there's more impingement happening at the top of the shoulder where the cuff is. So, again, pulling that bar down toward the front of your chest instead of back of your neck, things that can help protect it into what's happening at the shoulder.
Good luck. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Karen in Madison, on to you. Hi, Karen.
Yes.
What can we do for you?
An MRI showed that I have a very small cyst on my spine, lower, mid-lower back. And I had the MRI because I had a very numb foot, mostly right side of the foot, and a tingly leg here and there and now and then. There's no pain, it's just numb. There's no pain in the back, but there's a cyst. And they recommend that I have the cyst removed. Very small surgery, very small cyst. But it is back surgery. And there's no guarantee that the numb foot will get a lot better, but it probably won't get worse. And it, actually, sometimes, depending on the shoes I wear, I forget about it. I can walk a mile, or I can swim. I can do pretty much what I want as long as I'm careful how I sit. I carry a pillow with me.
Okay.
So I'm assuming that I'm making the right choices here, but I'm wondering if in your experience, I don't have a lot of people that have dealt, know a lot of people that have dealt with this or have any information on outcomes.
Right. Bill, what do you think?
Right. Well, and it's, and the outcomes are kind of all over the board. Karen, can I ask how long this numbness has been there, been present?
Well, let's see. What's this, February? I think it started, it got a little tingly before Christmas. I originally went to the physical therapist, I think, in November around Thanksgiving. And after our discussion, I had seen her before. She looked at me and she said, this isn't a physical therapy problem, it's a medical problem. So I made an appointment with physician. Physician said, you need to see a neurosurgeon.
Okay, all right.
And so I made the choice to have the surgery, but I can always change my mind. But I think I swim, I walk, I'm healthy. I've never had surgery, and I've managed to live 79 years without it.
Right.
I'm comfortable with the idea of doing it, but I would kind of like to have a sense of how this works out.
Yeah, well, again, I think it's a really good question to ask, and there really isn't a lot of data that we can hang our hat on. So you've had this, it sounds like, for maybe 8 to 10, maybe 12 weeks. You know, if the neurological symptoms, in your case, the numbness, is getting better, I mean, the cyst question is, why did the cyst develop in the first place? Sometimes there's a traumatic accident. Sometimes they can develop more slowly over time. And then the symptoms, are they getting worse or are they getting better? So if the area of numbness is getting larger, if you start noticing some weakness, I mean, you haven't mentioned
it's
any weakness.
It's getting larger when I lie down at night.
Okay. All right. And any numbness, I'm sorry, any weakness around the foot and the ankle?
No, because as I say, I can go for a 2-mile walk. I can swim half a mile,
okay,
which I did this morning.
Okay.
The leg, the foot doesn't like much, doesn't like swimming much, but it doesn't hurt.
Right.
It's
okay.
It's numb.
Okay, all right. Well, your surgeon is correct. There's no guarantee the numbness is going to change or go away. So then it just comes, you need to, I'm assuming you have a discussion, what are the potential risks of doing this surgery? And then it's elective from your
yes,
perspective.
Yes, it is.
And but I think what the surgeon said to you is correct in terms of my familiarity with the literature. Is there's no guarantees that numbness is going to go away or change.
But there's no guarantee the cyst won't grow.
That's correct. But you'll know when it grows because you'll start developing weakness, you'll have pain, or the pattern of numbness will change.
Yeah.
And then you could go back and then be reevaluated. So you'll know when it's changing there.
Well, I will probably go ahead and have the surgery, which is a few weeks down the road.
Mm-hmm.
I chose that over a cortisone shot since there's no guarantee the shots would work, and I could have the shots and still have the surgery later.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like you've thought this out, and you're working with somebody you're comfortable with and confident with.
Yes.
So I would go with what you have planned.
Good
so
luck.
You don't see terrible downsides to this.
Well, there's two things. It may not get rid of what you're calling about, and the surgery, even though it's a microsurgery, there's always risk for infection. If they're taking out part of the joint or a bit of bone to help get rid of the cyst, that changes the anatomy of your back.
I think the cyst is inside the spine.
Right. Well, oftentimes it's off of the facet joint, which again would be kind of inside. It's in the area where the nerves are coming out of your spine, out into your hips, into your leg. And I can tell you that most often the sequence I've worked with is people have the injection first, and then if that doesn't work, then they go on and have the surgery, maybe have the surgery.
Right.
But usually they do the injection first.
Well, I just...
That's okay. I mean,
it's
an elective process here, procedure. You're doing your due diligence by collecting information, and you just get to make the decision that you're most comfortable with.
Yeah.
There you go.
I guess I don't like shots.
Do you think you're not going to get any shots when you go in for surgery?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, just checking.
Hopefully they'll knock me out. This is... I'll be 80 in a few months and have had no surgery and very few shots. I've gone all through life with only with asthma, nothing else.
Yeah.
All right. Well, good luck.
Yep. Good luck with whatever direction you go in.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Shoot me an email or post on my page and let me know how this turns out for you, Karen, will you? Let's go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and post. I'd love to hear how it turns out. And Gene in Highbridge? Love to hear what you have to say. Give us your question.
Okay, I had prostate surgery on the 17th of November of 2011. Okay, and they snipped something in my urinary tract.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I bled after quite a bit. They left me overnight there, and then they had to put a catheter on me in a bag. And I did not like that. And I came home and, well, I waited 10 days and I went to Ashland and they tried to see if I could void. They filled me up with water and I tried and they wouldn't. I did that twice. Okay, on December 12th of 2011, I went to Duluth and I seen a urologist again. And he went in there with camera, and he did a little snipping, I guess, in that urinary tract. And I told the nurse and the doctor, I said, when I leave here, I'm going to leave that bag here. He said, I don't care what you say, because that is a nuisance. Mm-hmm. So I came home, and, well, they told me I had to catheterize myself. Mm-hmm. Well, I did that for twice. Okay, I started going on my own. And I didn't have no problem there.
Okay.
Well, once in a while, I'd check to make sure my bladder was empty. But the only trouble is it drips.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to wear men's underwear, well, like Depends and stuff.
Yep.
Right.
So he called me to ask see how I was doing. And I told him that I'm doing all right, but I'm dripping. I said, is there any pill that you can take? He said, no. He says, you got to do exercises.
Correct.
And what are those exercises that have to be done?
Well, those are Kegel exercises, and they're commonly associated with women because women tend to have more dripping and leakage issues following childbirth because of the trauma that happens in the pelvic girdle. But it happens in men quite often as well, particularly associated with these kinds of surgeries. There are physical therapists who specialize in what's called pelvic floor, and those are the muscles in your pelvis that support your urethra and bladder and so on and help control bowel and bladder. So a physical therapist who specializes in pelvic floor can help you, teach you those exercises to do, and they will help. And just like any other exercise program, there's ways to do it correctly. You typically do, isometric holding exercises, and you're holding it for as hard as you can for a certain number of seconds. And then you can do quick repetitive ones where you can elicit a muscle contraction quickly, because there are times, for example, when you're about to sneeze, when you've got to elicit that muscle contraction quickly. So a physical therapist who specializes in pelvic floor, they work with both men and women can instruct you in those exercises.
And it does work.
Yes, sir.
He told me that if nothing happens within 4 months, he says, then he'll want me back in Duluth.
Yeah, you should get in sooner, because the longer you go with those muscles not working, you know, it's kind of like after knee surgery. Before you go in for knee surgery, they instruct you in the exercises to strengthen your quadriceps and your calf muscles so you don't forget how to use those muscles after surgery. Same thing, the longer you go without remembering how to tighten those muscles and use them to control that leakage, the harder it is to find them again.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Gene. Appreciate your call. An email from Laura in Madison who says, I fell off my bike. My doctor diagnosed it as frozen shoulder syndrome. How do I help it heal?
Oh, frozen shoulder is a very, very challenging problem. The first thing is to make sure to rule out any pathology at the shoulder that's perpetuating the motion loss. And a frozen shoulder is pretty typically what it sounds like. You really can't move your shoulder very far in any direction. So the first step is to make sure you've ruled out pathology, because any pathology in the joint can perpetuate it. Thereafter, seeing a physical therapist on a periodic basis to advance your home exercise program seems to be the treatment of choice now. They'll see them more intensely at the beginning to get them going, to work through that first few weeks, and then it literally takes 12, 18, 24 months to get over this, and it takes diligence on the part of the patient to continue their exercises on a regular basis. Occasionally, the surgeon will go in and manipulate it. Outcomes aren't a whole lot better with manipulation.
Okay, Leslie in Tomahawk has a question for you. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, how is everybody today?
Great, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm actually calling for my husband, who unfortunately isn't here today. To make a kind of a long story short, he has a degenerative disc in his back, and he's had it for many, many years and has learned to live with it, because there's really not too much that can be done. The one really bad thing about it is when we're driving and he's sitting, it gets to be so uncomfortable that really limits our driving, even though we stop, you know, but about 2 or 3 hours max, he gets to the point where it's very uncomfortable. He made an offhand comment the other day as he was sitting here at home eating ice cream, and he said, you know, if I could eat all the time when I'm riding in the car, I wouldn't have a problem. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, because when I'm eating, if I'm eating a sandwich or whatever while we're driving, I don't feel the pins and needles and the achiness in my butt while we're driving. And I said, well, you need to call the therapists when they're on public radio and ask them that. And he said, yeah, and of course you're on today and he's not here. So is there any correlation between the physical act of eating and pain in that area?
Boy, I don't know, you know, Bill?
That's a new one.
It is a new one. You know, the only thing I can think of is that he's changing his posture or position in the car seat while he's eating.
Uh-huh.
You know, for this to be related to the degenerative disc disease, you know, the thing that can give people trouble with driving is not just only the sitting, but the vibration of going along on the road that just adds more stress to that low lumbar area. So, to be honest, I'm not sure I can make a connection between the eating and unless it's postural.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's postural, but it's also that he's probably engaging muscles in his core. I mean, it's tangentially related to the posture, but that he's engaging the muscles in the core to hold, to move, to manipulate, to get up. And so he's probably engaging more of his muscles and giving himself more stabilization when he rides. I don't know if he's ever tried a corset when he's riding in the car to provide a little external stabilization.
No, he hasn't.
Yeah. Right. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. That, or has he tried a lumbar cushion to support
it?
Okay.
Yep.
All right. And obviously that sounds like that has not helped.
Right.
Okay.
He's tried different kinds of pillows and different things like that. If he can adjust his seat where his thigh legs or from his thigh to his knee are pointed more on a downward angle,
okay,
that seems to help.
Okay.
But other than that, we don't have, unfortunately, a car that does that.
Oh.
But other cars that he's ridden in, you know, if he can adjust that seat down, it's more comfortable.
Then
it
feels
for him.
Better. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that again ties back to the posture, how important it is for him. Does he get the same symptoms when he's a passenger?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. One of the things that this would be more helpful when he's the passenger, besides eating all the time while you're driving, besides that, is there's what's called a backsling chair or a NADA chair. And again, it only works if you're driving, if you're using cruise control. But when you're a passenger, it's a pad behind your back, and there's two loops that go around your knee, and you can apply tension to those loops to give your back more or less support.
Oh.
And you can alter your posture by small amounts. I've had some people who have had some good luck with that, whether it's in the car or even on an airplane. Mm.
So, Oh, yeah, airplanes are torture.
Yeah,
I think they're torture for everybody. But.
Yes.
These days, yes.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Leslie, for calling.
Appreciate I'll do a little you. Homework over this next month and see what else I can
we'll
find.
We'll see what we can come up with, so stay listening. And you will be back.
We'll be back.
In about a month.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Maybe we can have more people who are listening who have back pain while driving try that. Of course, it might lead to the obesity epidemic. Only eat apples and carrots.
Yeah, that's right.
There you go.
Yes.
Oh, man. Lori Tyne Brody and Bill Boisenall, they will be back, and we will have them on again. They're great, aren't they? Tomorrow, Jack Socha talks with us about taking photos, digital photos. Stay with us.